This evening's shmuz is Le'ilui Nishmas, my mother, Alela Shalom, Sheinanecha Bas Shalom. May the schus of learning and hopefully the sorus be a Ilui Neshama. The Ramban explains to us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not in the miracle business. Once in the course of history, once in the course of mankind's existence, Hashem showed all of His might, all of His glories for the entire world to see. Those events were known by the entire populated world. It wasn't just the Jewish people who lived through tremendous revelations. Every human being alive lived through, understood, and was well aware of what had happened. And what that means is all of the makos in Mitzrayim, the Kriyas Yamsuf, the Jewish people receiving the Torah on Har Sinai, the Mun, the Be'er, all of the vast and awesome miracles were known by everyone, because this was the one time in history when Hashem was demonstrating to the world that He is the creator, orchestrator, and maintainer of all physicality. Interestingly enough, not many people got the message. Or if they got the message, not many people stepped forward ready to change. One individual who did was Moshe Rabbeinu's father-in-law Yisro. The pasuk says, "Vayishma Yisro Midyan Kohen Midyan Chosem Moshe." Yisro, the Kohen Midyan, the father-in-law of Moshe, heard as Kolasha Asalakim the Moshe Yisrael. He heard everything that Hashem did to Moshe Yisrael. Ki hotzi Hashem es Yisrael miMitzrayim, because Hashem took Yisrael out of Mitzrayim. Later on, Rashi tells us that he heard everything, as did everyone else. But what was it that made him come? Says Rashi very simply, Mashmua Shama Uba, what is it that actually made him come? Kriyas Yamsuf Umachamas Amalek. When he heard about two events, there were two pivotal events that actually changed him, made him decide to join the Jewish nation, that is the splitting of the sea and the Umachamas Amalek. Everything else he was aware of, everything else he heard of, but these were the two events that made him say, wow, this is astonishing. And those two events made him change his life. And if you think about this, Rashi, it's rather difficult to understand. Because Kriyas Yamsuf, we can understand. Kriyas Yamsuf is the single greatest revelation of Hashem's hand in the course of history. If you can imagine an entire ocean splitting, but not just splitting into 12 channels, the entire ocean bed dry with hundreds and hundreds of feet of straight walls, you could see through each channel. You could probably spend an entire week trying to tell over all of the vastness and the intricacies of the miracles of Kriyas Yamsuf. It is to this day one of the bedrock pillars of our Emunah. It's obvious why that should move him. It's obvious why that should make him say, wow, something's going on. But Milchamas Amalek doesn't seem to be in the same category. Amalek was an enemy of ours, who we greatly outnumbered. There were almost 600,000 men between the age of 20 and 60. Alu Chamushim, we left Mitzrayim armed. We far outnumbered Amalek. Now I'll grant you that there was a miracle in the war, because we were not really trained, we were not soldiers, and Amalek was a very, very bitter enemy. But at the end of the day, you cannot compare the two miracles. Kriyas Yamsuf is of unparalleled proportions. Amalek is a nace, it's a miracle, but it's much more of what you'd call your run-of-the-mill, everyday kind of nace. So why is it that of all of the things, Mon, Be'er, Matan Torah, everything that occurred, why is it specifically that it was Kriyas Yamsuf, the splitting of the sea, and the war with Amalek that made Yisro come? Why these two, and specifically, why the war with Amalek, when that seems to be nowhere near the same level? That's question one. Question number two is, Chazal tell us there was another individual who was moved by these miracles. The vast majority of the world, and in fact, to my knowledge, no one else really converted. Yeah, the Erev Rav, but outside of that group, to my knowledge, no one else converted, with the exception of one individual other than Yisro, and that was a woman named Rachav. If you know who Rachav was, she was not a woman of very high moral stature. The Gemara tells us that Rachav, from the age of 10 until the age of 50, was a tremendously corrupting force in her region. She lived in what was known then as Canaan. She was the zona who every pekid, every sar, every officer, every person of note and knowledge personally lived with this woman. She was astonishingly beautiful. And from the age of 10 until the age of 50, she was regularly mezana. At the age of 50, Yeshua is now bringing the Jewish nation into Mitzrayim. He sends in two messengers. He sends in two spies to sort of case out the area. Whose house do they show up in but Rachav's? And Rachav welcomes them in, and Rachav effectively saves their life. And Rachav at that point converts, and she says, the merit of my accepting these people, the merit of my guarding them, should be machaper, should atone, and I should become not just a convert, but forgiven for all of my years of what I did wrong. So here's question number two. Why is it that of the millions and millions of people alive at the time, it's Rachav, the prostitute, who hears the message, changes her life, and no one else does? And number two, how is it possible? From the age of 10 to the age of 50, she was a woman of ill repute, and in one decision, and then it's all gone, and it's all changed. How is it possible for her to reach such a tremendous level so quickly? So I'd like to see this evening if we can answer these questions and get a better understanding as to the state of what we understand as a human being, and ultimately what Hashem wants from us. And let me begin this with one observation. On May 11th, 1997, artificial intelligence made it. That was the day when Deep Blue, the IBM computer, beat Kasparov in the chess match, and that was the day when the machine fully won out over man. It was something that was kind of inevitable, but for many years in chess, man was always superior. That was a day when it all changed. Man lost to machine, and then it became very clear. Deep Blue was absolutely victorious. And I want you to appreciate what Deep Blue is capable of. It's a machine which is capable of thinking 70 moves into the future. If you're on a chessboard, if you do this, he'll do that. If you do this, he'll do that. 70 moves into the future. 2 million chessboard positions it's able to keep in its central processing unit at the same time. Kasparov was no match for it. He lost, and at this stage, many years later, it's not even a competition. Man against machine isn't. Okay. When you study this thing called artificial intelligence, you probably will make the interesting observation that they can do a lot. They can teach a machine to reason, they can teach it knowledge, they can teach it to plan, they can teach it to communicate, even perception. But I'd like to share with you that the two most difficult things to do in terms of Maisa Bereishis, the two most difficult things, if it could be, that we could ever think of Hashem doing, number one is creating something beyond artificial intelligence. And I'll share with you what that is. Artificial intelligence means you program a machine to do X, then do Y, if this, then that, if this, then that. An interesting thing happened in that match. The machine made a mistake. The programmers were sitting there, and they watched the machine make a move, and the two programmers who programmed the entire system said, "Oh, what is it doing? It made an error. It made a mistake." And they couldn't believe the stupidity of the machine. And not only did it make a mistake, it wasn't something that they programmed. And that move led to the checkmate. And only later on did the two programs go, oh, the machine kind of thought faster than we did, kind of programmed it out, thought through something we didn't think through, but it was something we had programmed in it before. And here's the observation. If you train a machine, it can only do exactly that which you made it do. It can only process exactly the way you processed. And if you'd like to understand the most difficult thing in the creation, it's creating something that has an agenda outside yourself. You can create a robot, it can sweep your floors, it could clean your roof, but it doesn't have an anochi. It doesn't have an I, it doesn't have an agenda, it doesn't have a self, it doesn't have a will. You see, it's programmed. If this, then that. If this, then that. There's no agenda. There's no I. There's no personal will. It doesn't exist. It's a machine. And I'd like to share with you why that's so. You ever wonder why science has such a difficult time defining death? What's so hard to define death? Death is very simple. As long as I'm in the body, I'm alive. The minute I leave, I'm dead. What's so hard? Very simple. I am the occupant of this body. When I'm in the body, I'm alive. When I leave, I'm dead. What's so difficult?
Scientists don't recognize the I as being something separate from the body.
The reason why scientists can't recognize the I as being something separate from the body is because from a scientific perspective, I don't exist. And I'll share with you what I mean. Physical science is very, very well equipped at measuring physical manifestations. Is it long? Is it tall? Is it broad? Is it dense? They can even measure luminosity, how bright is something. But you see, if you take I, put it in a beaker, and add blue dye to it, it doesn't change color. You know why? Because from a physical perspective, I don't exist. And that's kind of strange because I've always been here, been in this body all my life, and as long as I've been alive, I've been here. But from a physical perspective, I don't exist. You can't measure the I, you can't weigh it, you can't feel it or touch it. And one of the great breakthroughs, one of the great revolutions in thought is understanding that I am not physical, I am spiritual. And once you understand that, you understand why it's so difficult to measure death, it's so difficult to define the I, and then you understand why artificial intelligence will never create an I, will never create a will, will never create that independent das, because that independent das only comes from a spiritual manifestation, comes from an ashama, comes from something non-physical. Anything in the physical realm is a programmed entity. If this, then that. If that, then this. But to have your own identity, your own will, your own wishes, and your own sense of being, your own identity, only comes from a neshama, comes from a spiritual entity that's well beyond artificial intelligence. And if you think long and hard about Maaseh Bereishis, when Hashem took nothing and out of absolute nothing made the world, that's a rather stupendous event. When Hashem made the human eye, that's a rather impressive accomplishment. When Hashem took 100 billion neurons and weaved them into the human brain, it's a rather impressive accomplishment. But all of that pales in comparison with the creation of an independent das, with an independent will, with an eye who can rebel 100% against Hashem because it's a separate intelligence with its own agenda, with its own identity, not battle, not losing its identity to Hashem, a separate entity from Hashem. And that creation is far more difficult than taking nothing and creating something out of it, and far more difficult than creating oceans and mountains and suns and constellations because it's from a whole different realm. And that is the second most difficult thing, if it could be, that Hashem created. Would you like to know what the single greatest thing that Hashem created? The most difficult thing that Hashem created? That is something very different than the human. See, here's the question. How is it that Hashem could take a human who's so brilliant, who's so intelligent, and give him free will? Free will doesn't mean theoretically I could choose X or Y. Free will means practically. If you guys remember previous shmuzim, I've often used this example. Do you have free will to put your hand in a fire? Well, theoretically you could do it, but you never would. That's not free will. In theory, you have free will to put your hand in a fire, but practically you don't. For man to have free will, it means he could go this way, he could go that way. And here's the greatest dilemma in creation. How do you take an Adam, brilliant, insightful, understanding, put him into the planet for a few short years? He has a mission, a plan, a purpose. This is the gym, the ultimate chance to grow and accomplish. And when you leave this gym for eternity, you'll be exactly what you shaped yourself into. You know that. You're brilliant. You understand that. How is it possible that you could ever sin? How is it possible that you could do anything but What are you supposed to do? Every mitzvah helps you grow. Every avira damages you. How is it possible to give a human being free will? And that is the greatest creation that Hashem made. To accomplish that, Hashem had to blur the consciousness of man. And you'll excuse me if you know this joke, you could laugh ahead of the punchline, but to give you a mushel, here is a mushel. A very well-dressed man is kind of staggering and searching for his keys. Someone comes down the block and sees him staggering for his keys and notices he can't find them. And he says, did you lose something? And the manager says, yeah, I lost my keys. Instead of looking all around the light pole, looking here, looking there, find that a man says to the drunk, I can't find the keys. You sure you lost them right here? The drunk said, no, I didn't lose them here. Why are you looking here? Well, I lost them up the block, but there's light over here. I figured better look over here. Here's the point. In a drunken state of stupor, you look for the keys under the light, even though you know you lost them up the block, because there it's dark, here it's light. The consciousness is blurred. Your understanding is marred. You're not thinking clearly. If you've ever seen a young yeshiva guy in Purim, Shmuel, what are you doing?
I'm playing in traffic.
Shmuel, you're crazy. You're going to get hit by a car. Yeah, I know. Shmuel, you're going to go to the hospital. I know. I'll get to see the doctors in their white coats. It's so good. Shmuel, your bones are going to get smacked. I know. Then they'll put the pins in and I'll go through the metal detector. Bing, bing, bing. Shmuel, what are you doing? But you see, his conscious, brilliant understanding is blurred. He's not there. There's a tremendous mist and there's a tremendous clouding. His normal clarity of vision is gone and he's in a very different state. To allow for free will, Hashem did something me'in, something similar to that. But it's not quite drunkenness. It's not quite a stupor. It's a different sort of thing. Hashem took a nefesh ha-sichli, a brilliant, powerful understanding, the seichel, mixed it together with a nefesh ha-bahami, and put the two together. The seichel is brilliant, understanding and pure. The nefesh ha-bahami is the animal instincts in man, which are akin to every single animal. Find me an animal in the wild, you'll find all of the instincts, hungers, appetites, and desires. Within man are all of those instincts and appetites. The full nefesh. A dog has a nefesh. A baboon has a nefesh. Almost a personality, but not quite. But there's something that keeps the animal alive, something that tells it what to do, and tells it when to search, when to hunt, how to hunt. Within the human is that too. The I whom speaking to am comprised of both. Part of me is brilliant, understanding, wise. Part of me are pure appetites, desires, and I am in this sort of mixed up state. If you'd like to understand the human, all you have to do is go into the wild, find me a nefesh ha-bahami, parallel that in man, and you'll understand the human. The human is a very strange creation. Part of him is brilliant, insightful understanding, and part of him is blind as a bat. Part of him understands I'm here for a few short years, and part of him doesn't even remember what happened this morning. And if you're not quite sure that I'm right, I'd like to share with you an interesting philosophical question. Imagine for a minute the following. Imagine Eliyahu HaNavi comes to you and says, listen, I got some bad news. Nebuch, there's got to be something that happened to the Klal Yisrael. There's got to be a tragedy. It's either you break your arm and for 6 months you're going to be in pain, or Nebuch, Hashem says, I have to bring a earthquake to Yerushalayim and 100,000 Jews are going to die. Which is it going to be, your arm or the 100,000 Jews? I'd like to share with you what actually happens within the human if he's asked that question. Part of me says, what are you crazy? I'll break my arm in three places. 100,000 Jews, what's the Shiloh? Please, go ahead. And part of me says, what are you crazy? Break my arm? Let the Jews die, I couldn't care less. You're going to break my arm? I need this arm. This arm is what helps me move. This arm is very important to me. I don't want the pain, and other people don't exist. You see, this full half of my personality that doesn't care about anyone else cannot care about anyone else. The nefesh ha-bahami cannot care for anything outside of its direct programming. And even when the mother cougar is willing to give up its life for its young, It's only until the young is 2 years of age. And once the young becomes mature, the mother cougar will turn on it as an enemy, will kill it for breakfast. Because the nefesh habahami, the animal part of man, cannot care for anyone outside of itself, its instincts, its hungers, its appetites. And if you'd like to understand I'm sort of mixed up, sort of confused. I'm part brilliant, part dumb as sin, and part purely altruistic and giving, part purely selfish. I'm this sort of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, always in a state of flux, never getting it quite clear. The reason why Hashem put us onto this planet is to grow and to accomplish. And the more a person follows the Torah's way, and the more the person grows in learning in mitzvahs and avodas Hashem, the stronger the seichel becomes, the weaker the nefesh habahami comes. But as long as you're alive, as long as you're human, that part will weigh in, that part will influence, that part will be a part of what's going to make you decide what you're just going to do. Now, with that as a background, I have one more step I'd like to share with you. My son Shalom Ari, when he was 14 years old, was what I called a 14-year-old philosopher. He liked to ask interesting questions. And one of the questions that Shalom Ari used to like is as follows. Can an atheist be insured against an act of God? Can an atheist be insured against an act of God? An act of God is flood, earthquake, hurricane, tidal wave, all those good things. If you're an atheist, how could you take out an insurance policy that's going to pay you against an act of God? Let me share with you exactly what he was asking. It's actually an interesting question. You see, even those people who claim to be atheists have this sort of hovering respect for the big deal stuff in life. And certainly if you're not an atheist, even people who don't really claim to believe in God actively in their lives admit there are some things that are just too big. They're just too, I don't know, an entire city being wiped out with an earthquake, a typhoon, hurricanes. When you see such power, such control, when you see such order in the universe, but certain holes left, gaping clear holes, there's a certain awe that the human sits back and says, I get it, and that's God. I'd like to share with you something very fundamental and very key for understanding. Imagine that you and I are working on becoming fully, fully cognizant of Hashem's existence. And we work on it for a good long time. And we think about the fact that Hashem is involved in every particle of physicality. Nothing physical can exist without Hashem keeping it there. Hashem is with me 24/7, as I get up in the morning, as I go to sleep at night, as I get in my car, as I go through my day. And we really work on this for a few months. And then we're walking down the street, and a small dog, not a big dog, a small dog starts chasing me. What happens? Oh my goodness, I'm in trouble. What happened to God? What happened to Hashem? What happened to God behind every particle of physicality? Hashem is right here. Hashem is present. Why are you running with such fear from that dog? Would you like to know the answer to that question? The heart and the mind are miles and miles apart. The reason is quite simple. There's a part of me that's brilliant, insightful, and absolutely understands Hashem is present right here. And there's a part of me that totally denies it. There's a part of me that feels Hashem's presence, and there's a part of me that says there is no God because I don't see Him. The behemoth side of me only sees that which is revealed and immediate. The behemoth side of me is dumb as sin. Would you like to know how dumb? Baboons have been found in the wild, caring for their young long after the young died. It's a sad thing to watch a mother baboon carrying around its baby when the baby's been dead for 2 days. But the mother baboon didn't quite put two and two together yet. Because the mother baboon has an instinct, hold it, feed it, and it's supposed to do something. I don't know what it's supposed to do or not do, but it's just lying there. And it will carry around the dead baby for days without the light bulb going off. Oh my goodness, maybe the reason it's not moving is because it's dead. The behemoth is very, very blind, very, very stupid, and can't see beyond anything that's immediate and revealed. And now comes the great dilemma. How do I train the behemoth within me? How do I win out so that my wisdom, my understanding, becomes the controlling force, and my behemoth, the animal side, has no control? You have to talk to the behemoth. And how do you talk to the behemoth? The behemoth doesn't speak your language. You tell the behemoth, you know what? You want to drive me to that? Your passion, your hunger is going to bring me to that? You're going to bring me to Gehenna. I'm going to burn. I don't want to burn. You know what the behemoth says? What? Gehenna. I didn't see it. I didn't feel it. If you want to talk to the behemoth, you know what you have to do? You have to take the behemoth's finger and say, here, feel this fire. Oh, it hurts. Want to feel that some more? No. That's what's going to happen. And if you think I'm kidding, I mean this bezeh loshon. You can't tell the behemoth that electricity exists. You could put the behemoth's finger into the socket. Oh, I get it, mister. But you have to talk the language of the behemoth, because the physical part of man is very thick and doesn't understand anything other than that. And now, my friends, I'd like to share with you what I believe is the answer to the question. Yisroel was a tremendously wise philosopher. When he saw Kriyas Yamsuf, he saw God. That's Hashem splitting the sea into many channels. That's Hashem drying out the ocean bed. That's clearly an act of God. But then he saw the Muhammad Amalek. Wait a minute, God's actually involved in that stuff? The mundane stuff? The day-to-day stuff? Like the wars with swords and sharp edge and their people killing? And Hashem even saved them from that? Would you like to know why Amalek impressed Yisroel? It impressed him because it spoke directly to a part of him. He had been in wars before. He understood battles. He understood bloodshed. And it spoke to a part of him in a very powerful way, in a way more than did Kriyas Yamsuf. Kriyas Yamsuf is God. God is in the realm of the big picture stuff. Tidal waves, typhoons, earthquakes, that's God's realm. But you're telling me God's involved in the day-to-day running of things? God's involved in wars and fights? And God's here in the actual living of my life? That's a very different message. And the behemoth side of Yisroel was very, very moved because it spoke directly to him. He heard it, he felt it, and that was as effective as was Kriyas Yamsuf, because Kriyas Yamsuf is the big picture stuff, and the Hamas Amalek, the war, is much more to home, much more close to home, much more moving. And I believe that there's a tremendous lesson to us in this. You see, I guarantee we will not see Kriyas Yamsuf. Unless we're around at literally the moment when Mashiach comes, we'll never see that level of miracles. But here's the great Chiddush. We don't need that. What if you have one of those events when you say, I get it, it's Ashkacha, it's Hashem. I can't deny it. I couldn't earn a living. I couldn't pay my mortgage. And then the deal came about. It never should have come about. I knew it wasn't going to happen. And this guy showed up. And this guy said that. And the deal came through. And now not only can I pay my mortgage, but I can pay the next month and the next month. And suddenly things worked out. I couldn't get my kid into that yeshiva. And then somebody said something. Something happened. And I see it. I understand it. Or maybe my kid didn't go to that yeshiva. And it wasn't until years later that I understood why. And then I say the words, it's Ashkacha. That's Hashem's involvement in my life. My friends, that can have more an effect on you than seeing Kriyas Yamsuf. And you know why? Because seeing the sea split, that's God's stuff. If you saw there wasn't a sun, and Hashem made a sun, whoosh, 93 million miles away, you saw this powerful 100 billion hydrogen bombs exploding every second. You saw the brilliance of the sun come into existence. That would affect you. But as much as that can affect you, the single fact that Hashem is involved in my life, the fact that Hashem is taking care of me, the fact that Hashem saved me from this danger, and Hashem arranges things for me, can affect me as much because it speaks directly to me, speaks to that part of me that feels things, that part of me that worries, that part of me that's very, very physical, that part of me that lives in this world. And when you understand this, I think it's a fundamental understanding of life. And here is one more step. Rachav was the Balas Tshuva. Rachav became the convert. Would you like to know why I believe Rachav became the convert? And Rachav hit bottom. You don't get lower than that person. There was nothing left for her in this physical world. Everything was empty. Everything had hit bottom, and there was nothing left. When there's no benefit to the Nefesh HaBahami, and there's no benefit to the physical side, that side says, ugh. And she was able to perceive something that the rest of her generation couldn't. And she was able to perceive that this is a miracle. She saw Kriyas Yamsuf. She knew about it. She understood it. And she said, there's a God. And in one fell swoop, that brilliant side of her came to the core and came right out. And she said, this is correct. This is Emes. She changed her life. And she went not from 0 to 60 in 4.2 seconds. She went from 0 to a million in a heartbeat. She became a tremendous individual. She did tshuva on everything she had done wrong, apparently, and she became a great individual. And when you think about that, that's a rather scary thought. Because you see, every one of us, contained within me, is a brilliant, clear understanding of life. Every one of us have that exact part. I have a part of me that knows that Hashem is present right here. I have a part of me that feels Shabbos intensely. I have a part of me that only wants to learn, grow, and daven. I have a part of me that only wants to help other people. That's there. The problem is the other part is there also. If I could figure out what to do about that other part, if I could figure out how to stop it from stopping me, if I could figure out how to get it out of the picture, the part of me that's pure would grow and accomplish and reach tremendous heights. And one of the great secrets of tapping into the neshama is to find Hashem in your life, not in the big deal stuff, not when it was a major thing that's going to go in the art school biographies, when it's a little minutia, when it's a little thing that happened to you and you say the words, that's Hashem, and then I feel it. I feel it not with my seichel, I feel it with my body, I feel it with my essence, I feel it with every part of me. And if you take that and think it through, it will bring you to a very different sense, to a very different understanding. I was a young man in yeshiva when Yaakov Shweki was single. For those guys who learned in Rochester, you may remember, he was a regular guy. Didn't sing, I mean he sang every once in a while. No one knew about him, he was an unknown. He got married and in a heartbeat, he became an international sensation. He goes to Israel, they're like, fill up stadiums to hear him sing. He went from 0 to 60 in 4.2 seconds. He became a phenomenon in a heartbeat. What if I share with you that that same capacity every one of us have? If I could open my heart and say, I get it. Hashem is involved. Hashem is active. There's a part of me that can propel me, a part of me that can drive me, a part of me that can let me grow to such heights. Because there is a part of me that's properly created exactly for that. If I can just figure out how to get the other part to stop bothering me, to stop impeding me, then I could reach tremendous heights. And if I could just find one small miracle, one small time when Hashem helped me, and I say, I feel it, I get it, I can then spin out from that. You see, Hashem didn't just show up on the scene that afternoon. It means Hashem is always there. And Hashem didn't just suddenly take care of me. It means Hashem has always been there for me. And if you start spinning that out with your seichel and start understanding that, you can grow and grow. You can grow from 0 to 60 in but a heartbeat. You can reach tremendous heights because that's what Hashem created every one of us to be. I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn from Yisro. Yisro saw Kriyas Yamsuf and he saw Amalek. Why was he as moved by the war with Amalek as he was by the splitting of the sea? They have no comparisons one to the other. And once you understand the human, you can understand why. The second most difficult thing Hashem did in creation was create an identity separate from Him. Every one of us are a separate das from Hashem. What that means is a rock, a planet, the stars, the sun, the moons just are. There's a part of me that's far greater than all of that. There's a part of me that isn't just an if, that, then this, if, that, then this. There's a part of me that has its own identity, its own individuality, its own agenda, and its own wishes. That's one of the greatest things that Hashem created. But the single greatest thing that Hashem created was to give that part of me actual free will. Actual free will means I could go this way or go that way. But the part of me that understands is brilliant and insightful. How do you give it free will? You have to blur the consciousness. Hashem didn't make us drunk. We're not like Shmuel who wants to go play in traffic on Purim Day when he's drunk. But Hashem did make us drunk with a different sort of blurring of the consciousness. There's a physical side of me that enters in, that makes me desire things that I don't want, makes me need things that I don't want, makes me hunger for things that I don't want. And I am this strange entity, this Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, mixed up and confused, always desiring and not desiring, wanting and not wanting, always in this mixed up state. But once you understand that that's the human, now you can understand how to grow it. All of the mitzvahs help me allow the seichel to come to the fore, weaken the nefesh abahami, learning Torah, doing everything that the Torah wants from me, strengthens that part, and the other part becomes weakened. And as you spend your time appropriately, this becomes stronger and stronger. What Yisro saw spoke directly to the nefesh abahami. He saw Kriyas Yamsuf, that was wonderful, but as great as that was, the fact that there was a war with swords and danger, he spoke that language spoke to him, and it moved him. And the reason why this is so important to understand, because when you understand this, you understand how you could introduce Hashem into your life in a very big way. When you listen to the messages, when you see those strange events that happen, and you say, I get it, that's Hashem, and it moves you, it's not speaking to your seichel, it's speaking to the behemoth side of you. The behemoth side of you only feels it when you put the finger in the socket, when it touches the candle. But when Hashem actually saves you, that's when you feel it, and that's when you sense it, and you have a very different sense of things. I'd like to close with one last observation. Roe versus Wade was probably the greatest single change in the moral climate in this country. If you're not familiar with the case, in 1973, Jane Roe sued the state of Texas for the right to have an abortion. Basically, she was a pregnant woman. In the state of Texas, abortions were illegal. She was pregnant, wanted to have an abortion, and she was defended by two lawyers. This case went to the Supreme Court. In the end, she won the right of abortion in America. At the time, she was 25 years old, and at the time, she said the single greatest desire of her life. In fact, the only thing she wanted was to make abortion legal. She legalized abortion. Interestingly enough, this woman, whose real name is Norma McCorvey, 22 years later, saw a poster of a 10-week-old fetus. And she describes that she saw the fetus. And I'd like to share with you her words. The progression was so obvious. The eyes were so sweet. It hurt my heart just looking at them. I ran outside and finally it dawned on me. Norma, I said to myself, they're right. I had worked with pregnant women for years. I had been blind. That's a baby. It's as if blinders just fell off my eyes and suddenly I understood the truth. That's a baby. The woman who did more to legalize abortion in this country than any other single human being 22 years later realized she was dead wrong. Dead wrong. Would you like to know what dead wrong means? 1.3 7 million abortions a year in this country. 3,700 abortions a day in this country. This woman, Jane Roe, real name Norma McCorvey, was a tremendous part of that because she was the one who brought forth the legislation that legalized abortion. 22 years later, she says, sorry guys, I made a boo-boo. I was wrong. And now, interesting enough, she fights to make abortion illegal. What do I take from this? Number one, if you'd ever like to wonder whether man-based morality is to be questioned, let this case be the most powerful spokesman. The next time you feel, I know the Torah says X, but I feel Y, ask yourself this question. I'm brilliant, I'm wise, I'm learned, but I sure hope 40 years from now I'll understand things deep with a greater depth. I sure hope that I'll understand things better then. Do you think then I'm going to have the same vantage point as now? And if you're really convinced that you are, ask Norma McCorvey, because she had a very different vantage point. But that's not really what I want to focus on. What if I were to ask you as follows? What if I were to ask you, is it possible for such a woman to do tshuva? Is it possible after 22 years of bringing death to the world that she could just do tshuva and undo the damage she did? Oh, my friends, let me share with you a woman who had a parallel life. Rahav was about the most evil influence in her time in that region. It doesn't get worse than she. And in one heartbeat, one decision, she changes, she gets it, and like a rocket on the 4th of July, she takes off and she changes her life, and she says, let this be machapar on everything I've done up to now, and it seems that it worked. And would you like to know the why? Because that is the power contained within the human. Hashem understands we'll do things right, we'll do things wrong, and we might just mess up. And Hashem gave us a koach of tshuva, but more than anything, Hashem gave us a power in our neshama to change, to see truth, and to see emes, and to catapult ourselves forward. How many people saw the truth? Sounds like two. Outside the Klal Yisrael, maybe the Erev Rav, it was Yisroel, and it was Rachel, but two people did, and the good news for us is we are in the camp. And in the camp means we have the system, we have the Torah, we have the mitzvahs, and just doing this helps us grow and accomplish. And within me is this powerful, powerful rocket. If I could just hook into it and allow it to hit the skies, I can grow to such heights. And one of the great secrets of doing it is seeing Hashem in your life and then spinning that out and understanding how much Hashem is involved and helps us. And the Shir Bina Ili Nishmas to my mother, Shinanecha, Bashalom.